Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Tasha. Beyond the Headlines is a weekly current affairs show that aims to make public policy discussions more accessible to you. We take you beyond the headlines of our daily news, bringing you access to current leaders through in-depth interviews. You can join us in the conversation by tweeting at beyond_headlines. That's BYOND_headlines. In today's episode, we delve deep into the critical issues surrounding gender equality in Canada, especially in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. We explore the major challenges and developments in gender equality, paying special attention to the disturbing rise in gender-based violence during this period and how it varies across different regions in our country. Our conversation then extends to examining areas where Canada shows promising signs of gender equality, along with an in-depth look at the care economy. We discuss Canada's response to the care economy during and after the pandemic, comparing it with global best practices. Content warning. Please be aware that in this episode, we will be discussing topics related to gender-based violence, which might be sensitive or triggering for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Our first guest today is Catherine Scott. Catherine serves as the director for the CCPA's Gender Equality and Public Policy work. She has worked in the community sector as a researcher, writer, and advocate for the past 20 years, writing on a range of issues from social policy to inequality to funding for nonprofits. She is passionate about research that speaks to the aspirations of communities and supports collective action for change. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tasha.
Okay, let's just start broad. Can you help break down any major current gender equality issues happening in Canada right now?
That's a huge first question. Certainly, starting at the top, I mean, gender equality is a theme that runs around every dimension of cities, all communities, in fact. We can think about, you know, obviously economic status, income and poverty, and the cost of living crisis, and how that's playing out in Canada today. We think about housing. Women's health, certainly the aftermath of the pandemic has raised a number of really key challenges and critically impacted women who experienced such a high level of mental health challenge during the pandemic. We can think about violence. I mean, again, another really troubling outcome following was the increase in gender-based violence that women have experienced, certainly in 2020 and every year thereafter. Another area we can look at, women's representation, their experience, transportation, loss of public transit. There's, you know, a huge number of issues that are relevant to women in the cities today.
Okay, yes. And on that note, could you speak a bit more on Canada's COVID measures and how this response has affected women?
That's, again, another big question. I think Canada, you know, it's hard to believe it's coming on 4 years after COVID first hit in February 2020. And in the initial year, certainly, you saw governments at all levels, and that would be federal, provincial, and municipal governments mobilizing a massive response to deal with this uncharted, you know, this massive threat to public health and safety. The federal government, for its part, certainly used its considerable spending powers to mobilize and create income security support programs for households and businesses. You know, Canada actually was a world leader in terms of proportion of its pandemic spending that were directed to households, and certainly helped keep businesses afloat through the 18 months that followed. There would have been, you know, the employment shock was huge, and there would have been a massive rise in poverty had it not been for pandemic benefits. It was quite remarkable. In fact, Canada recorded a drop in poverty in 2020, and that was we saw all of that information that came out in the census, which was wholly attributable to these new pandemic benefits. At the same time, of course, the pandemic response was quite multifaceted, and the provinces and territories were in charge of the health response and the support and supports to families, particularly those who were struggling to care for people who were ill with COVID, or families, you know, certainly supporting their loved ones in long-term care facilities. And on that score, Canada, you know, the performance was, you know, appalling. We saw record numbers of seniors in long-term care homes die. Policy or response was inadequate to the magnitude of that disaster. So, and, you know, women, of course, you know, and this was very gendered, in the face of the crisis, many women had no choice but to leave work, you know, or step back to look after their kids or their loved ones at home, or to coordinate schooling in the provinces that had successive closures. So, you know, they did that with little support. So, I mean, really, the pandemic, many impacts on folks, much to learn. We did great. We did pretty strong. You know, the income side was, I think, an area where Canada excelled. Not so much on the care and economy, and they've had significant impacts on women ever since.
And could you also elaborate a bit on different dimensions of gender-based violence and how yeah. it played into the pandemic?
100%. That was one of the things when I talked about, like, some of the gender-based violence was not an unintended consequence. In fact, it was wholly knowable. There's a good literature, certainly across the world, but in emergency situations of different kinds, natural disasters or, you know, situations of war and so forth, that women and marginalized people are negatively impacted. And violence, actually, often gender-based violence often increases in those situations. And that certainly was true in Canada. You know, there was that eerie silence as people were locked in, were at home through the spring in 2020. And we saw a decline of violence noted, folks, you know, in the streets and so forth. But in the homes, stress and tension was building, and then, you know, the phones were ringing off the hooks at gender at shelters and rape crisis centers for people reaching out for assistance. So we saw an increase in gender-based violence from intimate partners in 2020, and it has increased in 2021, 2022, and it's been actually on an upward trend for about a decade now. So very troubling. And, you know, there's the reality of the violence, but, you know, at the time, there was money flowed from the federal government in particular to shelters and so forth to pivot, and, you know, in the context of the pandemic, to try to reach out and create ways of supporting women and gender-based folks who are reaching out for assistance. You know, all of those monies are now gone, and yet we have elevated rates of gender-based violence. We just marked last week was December 6th, of course, which was the day, a commemorative day for the 14 young women who were murdered in 1989 in Montreal. And, you know, folks in the anti-violence movement, the shelters are really ringing, you know, the alarm about the state of the community response and the inadequacy. We have a new national action plan against gender-based violence that was announced in November 2022. Different bilateral agreements are being negotiated between the federal government, provinces, and territories, but there's no information on those agreements. We're not sure what's happening. The response remains very patchwork across the country, as is so often the case in Canada in areas like this, whether it's childcare, care services generally, huge variation between jurisdictions. So there's a long way to go for a comprehensive response to violence. And that's one of the key pandemic legacies for sure.
And when it comes to gender-based violence in Canada, are there any differences across regions?
Yeah, well, you know, that's certainly true. There's large differences, and, you know, that's been evident in the data. The data we have, of course, let's remember it's typically from, it's either from the police, so it's police reported data for the folks who actually report. And we know, of course, in violence that there's huge underreporting. Women do not come forward for many hugely legitimate, important reasons. So we're really scratching the tip of the iceberg. But from the police reported data, we know there are big differences, certainly between the provinces and different communities. Rural areas do report higher levels of violence. The territories within Indigenous communities, the Western provinces tend to have higher levels of violence than Ontario or Eastern provinces. You know, reflecting, and we can speculate, but this has been a trend for a long time. Atlantic Canada, for instance, tends to be older. You also have large urban areas where the rates of violence are lower. But I think it's important to look below the geographic trends too, to understand where violence is happening in the unique communities and the challenges specific communities have, because you know, you can say, oh, it's higher in rural areas than urban areas, but we can't discount the huge issues and challenges, for instance, in facing newcomer women who also report higher levels, or women with disabilities. So it's important to take that kind of nuanced perspective as we to understand this challenge so we can generate a response that's effective.
And to your knowledge, what are some beneficial or more effective policy actions that can be taken to address issues of gender-based violence?
Well, you know, we have lots of, I would say certainly the shelters and the anti-violence movement have been very clear about some of the measures. One of the things, you know, largely in Canada, we continue to have a response that is run and structured by nonprofit organizations that receive very precarious funding. Typically, they'll have some core provincial, depending on the government, a base of some sort, often from provincial governments, and then rely on the rest of the time on generating income to support this, whether it's bake sales or whatever. I'm just, for such a fundamental public service such as anti-violence services, you know, they invariably, shelters and the like, are hugely precarious as related to their funding model. That is one of the clearest things we can do, is to, you know, to acknowledge what an egregious violation of human rights the existence of gender-based violence is, and to appropriately fund community-based responses to it. So that's been a struggle forever, and it continues. You know, there's and as I mentioned earlier, it's really acute right now. You know, there are other dimensions to the gender-based violence problem. So you've got community response, but for instance, many women end up staying in violent situations because they don't have housing to access or to go to, whether the apartment, for instance, might be in their partner's name, or for a variety of reasons, they may not have sufficient funds to move their child, you know, whether they have kids or whatever, out of the household. So the lack of deeply affordable housing, the lack of transitional housing is a real barrier that the folks in the shelter movements have been decrying for years, and hugely acute right now, given the housing crisis that Canada has undergone in terms of high cost of rent. You know, it really is exacerbating the situation for women confronting violence. So that's another, and folks as well in the immigrant settlement agencies talking about the challenges they face serving women in their communities, who, you know, have their challenges with the current structure of immigration law. So there's a lot of different ways that Canada could do better in supporting in the move to eliminate all gender-based violence.
And do you think having sort of this like nationally, this national approach, this like federally led approach to addressing gender-based violence is a good decision?
Well, I think, you know, the approach should be community led. It should be centered on the experience of those who experience, the people, the folks who experience and serve in that community on a day-to-day, have that knowledge. Where we need a national approach, we need a national coordination. So the idea that the services that might be available to a woman in Vancouver versus one in Brandon, Manitoba versus somebody living on the South Shore of Montreal, you know, there should be some consistency. And that's what I think is really useful, the federal government obviously providing funds, but having standards, national standards that apply. And that's true in different care areas like long-term care. How can we avoid the disaster that unfolded in the pandemic? One of the tools we have is to make sure that the funding is adequate, but it's tied to national standards that, you know, are, you know, grounded in evidence and actually, you know, ensure that folks don't have this hugely variable experience. That's the importance. And, you know, the perennial challenge in Canada is, you know, this dance between the provinces and the federal government about who's responsible for what and how do you ensure outcome. And, you know, we're in a place, you know, you look at an issue like gender-based violence and it's like, you know, enough of that. Like, there are ways to move this forward. We've got to get serious about making sure that people's, you know, if we're going to eliminate violence, we really need to make sure that the funding is truly directed in ways that support and uplift women and folks experiencing that, experiencing violence. So that, I think we need community-driven responses, but we need comprehensive framework to ensure that folks across the country have equitable access to what they need.
And are there any other demographics or any other issues that you think really affect women and different people in terms of federalism and like that kind of that mix of like interjurisdictional?
Healthcare is a great example. We talked about long-term care, but here's one of the issues certainly that should resonate. coming out of the pandemic, and it's been quite stark, has been the really sharp increase in mental health challenges that young women are experiencing. And in fact, the data is like, oh my God, like it's quite startling increase in the percentage of young women reporting mental health challenges of different, you know, whether it's anxiety or depression and so forth. And so again, this has been a long-standing challenge in the mental health community, trying to secure designated funds. You know, obviously the federal government provides a great chunk of the health budgets of each province and territory through the Canada Health Transfer. But, you know, those monies are obviously used by the provinces, typically in tertiary care and so forth. So then the mental health folks have been pushing for a long time for a designated transfer. They need to build up community-based mental health supports, and the need right now is just not as acute. So there are people really pushing forward with community-based responses, new innovations that have been brought forward to meet this huge unmet need, certainly among young women that we're experiencing it right now. So that's certainly a pressing issue that demands coordinated response. As well, obviously, Indigenous women are leading efforts to improve the status, not only on the violence for the response to the murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls inquiry, but also the community infrastructure and support for Indigenous women and girls in their communities and in urban, you know, for them, you know, 50% of folk are Indigenous folks who are living in cities and urban areas in Canada. That's another big area. So there are a variety of things that are really percolating right now that demand attention.
And would you mind speaking to where in Canada there are better indicators of gender equality? What cities are kind of implementing some relatively more effective or stronger approaches?
Well, you know, it's very difficult to point to individual cities, partly because, of course, the tools that impact women's quality of life, of course, are impacted by different levels of government. And cities are, you know, obviously creatures of provinces and territories, and they have a limited number of tools at their disposal. But, you know, certain cities have stepped forward to try to bring a much more feminist or an intersectional lens to their policy work and what they can do. I mean, obviously, it's going to be fascinating to see how the new Mayor Chow is doing in Toronto, certainly moving forward on some of the proposals and certainly around affordable housing and the like, and how that will impact women. There are many community organizations in cities across the country that are trying to mobilize to improve representation of women and gender diverse folks and other racialized communities in city governance, which is really important because it's a big issue to be, you know, have folks that actually have that lived experience in decision-making roles. So everything from planning appropriate transportation routes that, you know, hopefully bolster public transit. Women, of course, are disproportionately larger users of public transit. How are we going to service and save and stabilize public transportation systems in the post-pandemic? That's another key issue. But in terms of which cities are best, I think it's quite variable. So it would depend on the indicator you were talking about. But I mean, all cities, obviously, I think the imperative is to move forward with a feminist lens that really focuses on what the needs and realities are of women and gender diverse folks living in those communities and how best to support and facilitate them, you know, to start questioning these assumptions. And I think that's the period we're in. Some cities are doing that better than others.
And so what you're saying kind of reminds me of this thing of descriptive versus substantial representation. So I'm curious, do you think that, you know, having more women politically represented on cities or in different areas actually does improve gender equality?
Well, you know, I will be the first to tell you, I don't never take an essentialist perspective to public policy. We know lots of women who are in power at the current moment who are bringing forward what would be considered anti-feminist policies. I don't know if you just name names. We have provincial premiers. We have international examples. And that goes for everyone. I don't think there's anybody that you can say is because a person is from a particular community that they will necessarily subscribe to particular policies. But what you can say, and the data bear this out, is that the more with respect to gender, the more women who are in positions of power, or whether that be as representatives in decision-making tables or in the judiciary and so forth, you tend to have more positive, progressive, like on balance, looking across large data sets, you have more progressive public policy initiatives being advanced, where, you know, the idea being that people, again, people's lived experience is, it comes to bear on a set of decisions that confront. So that, I mean, in the aggregate, better representation is important. It's not going to deliver individuals, not speaking about a particular individual, but in the aggregate, these sorts of things do. And, you know, it's interesting, even in the business community, you know, there's lots of debates around, for instance, corporate boards, right? Like, and tracking these measures. And there's a good literature that suggests that diverse corporate boards actually produce better outcomes, and healthier businesses and better work, you know, certainly more inclusive work forces or those sorts of outcomes, which are really positive to the bottom line using that particular metric. So, yeah, so I would make that distinction that it remains an important fight to ensure that people's voices are represented in decision-making bodies.
That's very interesting. I guess we're going to wrap up, so I'll let you go in a few seconds. But sure. Before we go, could you maybe share where listeners could find more about your work or connect with you?
100%. I'm very happy to direct you to the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. I'm in the national office and I work on gender and public policy work there. My name is Catherine Scott and people can reach me at kscott@policyalternatives.ca. You can check out our website. We have several offices across the country and there are researchers attached to those offices looking at policy alternatives in a variety of areas, environment, trade, lot of labor market work. So please seek us out and we're always happy to. And we have a blog as well called The Monitor, and it's called monitormag.ca, posts almost daily with different blogs from our researchers, but also our research associates on a huge range of topics that might be of interest to your listeners.
Perfect. Okay. Thanks so much, Catherine.
Hey, Tasha, good luck with this.
Once again, that was Catherine Scott of the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, who has joined us for a discussion on current issues in gender equality in Canada during and following the pandemic. Thank you for tuning in for Beyond the Headlines. Remember, you can join us in the conversation by tweeting at us at Beyond the Headlines. That's BYOND_headlines. And checking out our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net or by following us on Instagram at Beyond the Headlines. Thank you for joining us. Our second guest today is Ido Peng. Ido is the Canada Research Chair in Global Social Policy and the Director of the Center of Global Social Policy at the Department of Sociology and the Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy at the University of Toronto. She is a leading researcher and expert in global social policy and political economy, specializing in the care economy and in family, gender, migration, and climate change policies, and a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. Ido is currently leading two international projects. The first is Care Economies in Context, Towards Sustainable Social and Economic Development, a global partnership research project that investigates care infrastructures in 9 countries in 5 global regions and uses that data to develop gender-sensitive macroeconomic models of care economies in these countries. The second project she leads is Care and Climate Change Policies Project, aimed to compile a package of policy briefs on different dimensions of care and climate change. She is also a distinguished fellow of the Asia-Pacific Foundation of Canada and currently serves as a thought leader for the Foundation's Women's Business Missions to the Asia-Pacific Initiative. And she was a co-lead for the Room 5 for the Rockefeller Foundation Brookings Institute 17 Rooms Global Flagship Project. Hi, Ido. Thank you for joining us. So please walk us through how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted the care economy in Canada. What are the vulnerabilities within the care economy that COVID has exposed or exacerbated?
Right. A good question. So I think the COVID-19 pandemic has really made it very clear the importance of care and care work, both for paid and unpaid care sectors, in supporting and maintaining the health and well-being of our society and our economy. So that's one of the impacts, right? So for example, it has shown that without care and care work, children will not be able to socialize and learn to grow to be productive members of society. Health care services will be overburdened. Sick and older people will die early death, and people with disabilities will have to manage on their own. So we also have seen parents struggling to manage their work and childcare during the school and daycare center closures. We saw so many older people in long-term care homes dying unnecessarily and being isolated and lonely because they were not provided with adequate services and care, and their families were not able to come into long-term care homes to see them and care for them. So I think the physical and mental health impacts and the social and economic costs of the sort of pandemic were huge. I guess this is not just in Canada, but probably across the globe. So I think pandemic has actually had a huge impact on the care economy in Canada and abroad.
Thank you so much for walking me through that. Now, before we go any further, for those of our listeners who might not have a very strong grasp, of the care economy, do you mind walking us through how this is a gendered issue?
Well, care economy is an important gender issue because we know this is not just in Canada, but across the globe. The majority of care providers, both paid and unpaid, are women and girls. And so when, there are numbers of reports, for example, IOO report has shown that over 70% of the paid care workers are women. We also know from our research, sorry, from our research and surveys in Canada, the majority of unpaid caregivers are also women. And it has impact on sort of women's lives and well-being. Not only is it that it does unpaid care work create barriers for women to women to have careers and proceed in having full-time work. And also in other countries, unpaid care work also creates barriers for women to have education, training, and to participate in other social and economic activities. In terms of the paid care work, although majority of paid care workers are women, most of these jobs, unless you're doctors, right? Most of these jobs are really low-paying jobs, and with sort of not the best working conditions. So again, it is a gender issue, partly because care work is always being considered as a kind of women's work, and therefore there's a real implicit cultural and normative bias against care work that has to do with the gender inequality.
Perfect, thank you. Now, would you mind maybe speaking a bit to some of the key challenges faced by caregivers, both informal and formal, in Canada during the pandemic?
Well, I think key challenges faced by caregivers, both informal and formal, in Canada during the pandemics were quite huge. Let me just give, let's say, three challenges. I think first is that there, you know, that the first challenge was clearly and it still is, a huge demand and not enough supply. So this is for both informal, and by that I'm guessing you mean unpaid caregivers, right? And formal caregivers. The pandemic has resulted in a huge demand for care, as I mentioned. Many people got sick, and that meant that many people had to look after and care for the people who are sick, whether they're in hospitals or long-term care facilities or at home. So that was a huge challenge. And also partly because of the lockdowns. So there were not enough nurses, doctors, caregivers to provide care in the formal sector. But also at home, family members also had to increase the amount of care work and paid other work they had to do, partly because schools and daycare centers and other care services were suddenly no longer available. So there was a serious supply and demand problem and challenge. I think the second thing, challenge was, of course, for many informal caregivers, they were faced with huge stress and tension of having to sort of manage more care while still have to work at the same time. In other words, they were suddenly confronted with this double and triple shift work that they had to do, and they had to do everything all at once. So I think working, you know, to be honest, I think working parents probably had the most challenging time during the pandemics because, you know, they really had to manage work and family work and care all together, all at the same time without much support at all. And I guess the third thing, this is for formal paid caregivers. I think that the probably the biggest challenge must have been the increased workload. So we now know from many surveys and studies that many frontline workers like nurses and PSWs and other people, they've really found their workload really increasing suddenly because of the huge demand and not enough people to do the work. And so as a result, many of them really experienced, you know, huge stress, burnout, and of course, not surprisingly, many frontline workers basically left their job, or they were thinking about, you know, quitting their job because of the so much work and stress.
Okay, and have there been any notable shifts in government policies or investments maybe related to the care economy in response to the pandemic?
Yeah, good question. I think in a way, yes. I think there has been some shift in government policies to invest in the care economy. So for example, the federal government, you know, back in 2021, put about, what, $30 billion investment in early learning childcare, or what they call ELCC, over 5-year periods. So that happened in 2021. And, you know, within a year and a half, almost all the 13 provinces and territories actually signed onto this, right? And similarly, there also has been some investment, although not very clear, some investment in long-term care, but they are not as, I think they're not as ambitious or coherent as the investment in childcare. And there has been also discussions about, you know, Canada Disability Benefit Act, or what they call Bill C-22. That's now still under discussion. But again, I think the process has been really slow. Even with the ELCC policy, even though federal provincial agreements have been achieved, almost 2 years ago, the rollout has been really slow. And in some cases, you must have heard on the news recently that some childcare centers are facing closures because the provincial government's fundings are not quite reaching to them quick enough. So I would say in terms of the effectiveness, these policies, I think it's still really hard to say how effective they are, because I think they're moving very slowly. I understand that, but I think it could move a little bit faster. It also appears that, well, policies like childcare investments seems more like an aspirational policy than effective sort of practical policies. And then other policies like long-term care policies are not even getting off the ground. So I think sort of this aspiration, you know, and sort of promise, and then the reality, and then there's reality. So the two are not quite in sync with each other, I say.
And why do you think this is?
Yeah, I think it's I think there must be many different factors and reasons to this. I think it has to do with our federal political system, because, you know, many of these policies in Canada at least, you know, many social policies require both federal and provincial collaboration and cooperation. And I think when you have multiple levels of government involved in it, that the political process is a little bit more complicated. I study, for example, social policies in the UK or in Japan and South Korea and those places that have more central government system, policy process might flow a little bit faster because you know there isn't that complication of having to negotiate and deal with provincial or state government level. And so I think maybe in the case of federal systems, the policy process might take a little bit longer because of the multiple government negotiations. I also think part of the reason for sort of the slow process might have to do with, you know, the at least in the case of Canada, policies are highly political, and so, you know, it's sort of, and often what I see is that, you know, childcare policy, you seem to get fairly much stronger sort of buy-in from both policymakers and the from the public, but long-term care policies are a little bit more challenging because I think there isn't a kind of coherent public sort of agreement about how long-term care policy should be sort of provided, developed, and organized. And so I think in that sense, probably it's much easier for the government to say, yeah, we're going to invest in childcare policies because their children, the future of the, you know, our, you know, future, and it's a really good investment and public seem to agree with it. Whereas long-term care and disability care are much more challenging because, you know, it's much more difficult to see have that kind of coherent agreement on investing in that sector.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense. And on that note, what lessons do you think Canada can learn from other countries in terms of effectively addressing the care needs of its population amidst a crisis like COVID?
Yeah, I think Canada could learn from other countries, particularly looking at some of the innovative ideas and experimentations that's been happening. I'm thinking here of one of the really interesting sort of local experiments that we've been looking at and working on, and I think and so I think that might be interesting. So what I'm talking about is this program called Manzana del Cuidado, or the Care Blocks in Bogota, Colombia, that we've been looking at and working on. This is so just to give you a background to this, I lead a very large global partnership project called the Care Economies in Context, where we're trying to map out and calculate the shapes and sizes of care infrastructures in 9 different countries, and using this data to develop gender-sensitive macroeconomic models of these countries to inform policymakers and NGOs and other social actors to really push for policy changes. And one of the country teams in my project is actually in Colombia, and we've been looking at the Care Blocks initiatives that actually began as a kind of local project within Bogota, initiated by the mayor's office about maybe 4 years ago. Originally, it was intended to serve as a kind of place where unpaid caregivers in the neighborhood could bring their children or older people that they were caring for and get some respite care for themselves. But as they began to provide this program, they realized that in addition to providing respite care, they could also provide some healthcare services for the older people, also skills training for the women who come and get the respite care. And then from there, they began to kind of expand on the programs that they're providing, including recreational programs like dance classes and fitness classes, laundry facilities. And before you know it, it kind of grew from a very simple respite care program that was provided locally to the neighborhood, women in neighborhood, into almost like a shopping center style care blocks. And so they began, and it became extremely successful, extremely effective. So they began with like 2 experimental projects when it started about 4 years ago. Now there are 20 scattered around the city. And so it's a really successful sort of, it's a really successful local program. And I think sort of what's really interesting is that, we need to learn from that kind of local innovations and experimentations, because I think the most innovative programs are actually happening at the local level. And so, as I mentioned, I've been studying and working with people in Bogota, who are in charge of this project for the last few years. And what we did actually, this is another side project, is that we're now working with a global NGO called City Hub and Networks for Care Gender Equity. And just last year, we got a huge grant to use Bogota's care block model and adapt it to Freetown, Sierra Leone in Africa. What we're trying to do is a kind of scaling up Bogota's very innovative program to address care economies to other countries and in different contexts. So I think it's really exciting. I guess what I'm trying to say is that, I think some of the interesting and exciting innovations are actually happening at the local municipal level right now. And I think Canada could learn from this. Actually, I'm actually right now in conversation with the City of Toronto to develop effective programs, you know, that would address the care needs of the people in the city, and creating city learning labs to monitor, assess, and share the learning with the people and with other levels of government and with other cities and governments in other countries. And what we're looking at, what I'm proposing to them is, like, think about Bogota's care block. Imagine this in Toronto, you know, is it possible? And how can we kind of adapt some of these ideas into our local, local communities? So I think Canada could learn a lot from other countries.
Wow, that is fascinating. And I would agree that Canada has a lot to learn in that regard. Do you know, to your knowledge, is there anything like this happening in Canada? Are there any innovative initiatives that have emerged within the care economy that you could speak to?
Well, I don't know of any right off the bat, but, you know, as I mentioned, I've been talking to people in the city government in Toronto, and they're very interested, and they've been saying, yeah, we, you know, it will be a really interesting project to have. We are now, as I mentioned, we are now putting together yet another proposal for different sort of grants to see if we could actually try out sort of this kind of learning from other local governments like Bogota's care blocks, and adapt and scale them to different cities globally. Right now we have about six cities that are interested in doing this, and that include Barcelona, Santiago, Freetown, of course, and a couple of other cities in Toronto, and a couple of other cities, in one in India, and maybe one in the Philippines. We're sort of talking to people in those places and say, you know, can we sort of try out this model and see if it works or not? And can we also at the same time create city learning labs so that we could create a kind of community, global community of learnings around care, but not just care, you know, care and climate change and other sort of social policy issues. So yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting potentials for Canada and in this, particularly in this area of the care economy.
Thank you. And on that note, I do have one last question. It might be a big one, but I want to know, how do you foresee the future of the care economy in Canada?
Yeah, that's a very big question. I think it's a very important question, so I'm glad you asked. I think we're at a very important and very critical moment in developing sort of more coherent and robust care infrastructures to support the care economy. I think it's really important. I think this will require a number of different things and policy changes that has to cut across different sectors. So for example, we need, in addition to like investing in universal childcare and universal long-term care and disability care, I think we also need to sort of invest in more generous maternity, parental and family care leave systems. I think we also need policies to incentivize employers to hire and retain and support women to succeed in the market. That means provide, you know, the employers have to also play a role in providing like direct care services, flexible working hours, mentorships, evaluations that attend to, you know, both men and women's care responsibilities, education and training to change workplace culture. I think we also need policies to really redistribute unpaid care between women and men. So, for example, I think I'm a firm believer of non-transferable paternity leave and care leaves for men. We do have that in Canada, particularly, you know, Quebec has done a really good job in sort of introducing this very early on. But I think it needs to be strengthened and pushed forward. I guess what I'm trying to say is that this kind of policies will, in the long run, really facilitate gender and social norm change. We need to change the sort of social norms and culture about care. I think we also need to reassess labor and occupational skills and wage structures, particularly in relation to care work, so that fits the real 21st century economic and labor market context, right? Because the current occupational skills sort of assessment is really based on the 19th and 20th century kind of industrial economy kind of mindset, and which undervalues sort of the kind of soft skills, caring skills like care work. So we need to really reassess those labor occupational skills and wage structures. And I think we need to, by doing that, I think it might help improve the quality of care by raising the wages and improving the working conditions of care workers and altogether. There's a lot of things that need to be done, and I think we could do a lot more on that.
Wow, thank you, Ido. This has all been really fascinating, and I really appreciate your insights. Before I let you go, we want to hear a bit more about these projects that you've been working on currently.
Yeah, right now I'm working on a project that builds on my care economies in context. And it's what we're trying to do is intersect care with climate change. I was asked by the Royal Society of Canada to kind of put together a team of researchers and policymakers. To sort of do a report on care and climate change policies. So I'm working on that, and this is proving to be really interesting and exciting. So in the future, if you're interested in care and climate change, come back and ask me. We're still at the beginning stage. So yeah.
Definitely we will. That sounds like very important and very great work, and I'd be happy to check back in for updates down the line. Best of luck with those research projects, and thank you so much again for joining us today, Ido.
No problem. Okay, see you. Bye.
Once again, that was Ido Peng, who joined us for a discussion on Canada's care economy. Thank you for tuning in to Beyond the Headlines. You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. That wraps up our show for this week. Today we were joined by Catherine Scott and Ido Peng. Many thanks to them once again for coming onto the show to discuss critical issues surrounding gender equality in Canada, especially in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic and beyond. Today's show was produced by myself, Tasha, alongside my co-producer, Janital Audrey. If you liked today's episode, please like and review us wherever you are listening. The views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, CIUT, The views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, CIUT, or the Hmong School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. If you missed any part of the show, be sure to check out podcasts of all our episodes on our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net, as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you're a fan of our show or want to stay up to date with the policy issues in Canada that we discuss, follow us on Twitter at @BYOND_headlines. You can also check us out on Facebook and Instagram. Be sure to tune in next week as we continue to take public policy discussions out of the hallways and onto the airwaves.